Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, August 15th, 2013. And tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about solar system conditions that would create a sulfur dioxide comet, or conditions in a comet that would be contributing factors of sulfur dioxide. How does that happen? Why is it important? Could it be happening right now with Comet Ison? And that's why we see all of the NASA hype and the disinformation piece that came out with a woman named Patty Broussard saying that there's a second sun near Jupiter and it's coming in with seven planets, and just complete baloney. Absolute complete baloney. But the one central thing result is that supposedly this is pushing a red cloud. What a scientifically poor description from somebody that claims to be a high level government scientist. A red cloud. Well, in chemistry, we talk about chemicals that appear red because of the reflectivity of the chemical. And that happens to be sulfur dioxide. So anyway, I'll be talking about the sulfur dioxide comets. Also, I'll be talking about electrical conditions. There's so much misinformation and misunderstanding. If we had a major power surge, what exactly would happen? For example, people talk about EMPs from a nuclear blast. Well, that's not going to take out the whole country. EMP blasts, I think you'd be, if a nuclear bomb goes off near you, I think you should be more worried about the nuclear bomb than an EMP. I mean, they're totally sidetracking the whole issue about this issue with Korea. If somebody lets a nuclear bomb off, the last thing you're going to worry about is a bit of EMP. You got to worry about the nuclear bomb going off. So anyway, the things that people get sidetracked on, the silliness, anyway, so I'll talk a little bit about that. But I want to talk about EMPs from the sun, from solar flares, so-called kill shots, and what can they do and what can they not do, so that you have a good understanding of that. Anyway, okay, first of all, let me just talk a little bit about... I'm just trying to order what I'm talking about here. The collaboration urged for climate change and finance communities. Now, this is kind of a lead story. This comes from the American Geophysical Union weekly newsletter. It says that scientists are organizing in Washington, D.C. This actually took place last June, and the American Meteorological Society talking about what they can do to tailor their science towards the needs of the financial community. Now, this is the tail wagging the dog. And this is, once again, let's go back to Eisenhower's speech. A couple weeks ago, I played it on the air. His Eisenhower's 1961 departure speech, as he turned over the reins to John Kennedy, he said that the biggest problem is organized government-sponsored science. And now what's happening? Well, with government funding sometimes iffy, scientists and scientific groups, more so the scientific groups, are looking towards private financing. So they have to tailor their science into something that will bring a financial return. There's got to be a financial return here. If somebody is funding science in the financial community, the number one thing they are looking for is a financial return. So why would banks or investors want to invest in financial scientific research regarding climate change? What's the payback to the financial industries? How do they get their money back? Well, therein lies the issue. if they can get the scientists to jump up and down and say, climate change is bad, we're going to have water problems, water shortage, then the financial communities can invest in water and get a tremendous return on investment. But they need the scientists out there jumping up and down and doing this. But, you know, Obama is pushing climate change as an individual policy. It's not that, how does Obama know about this? I mean, he reads the newspaper like other people possibly, but he's a president. And really, he's middle management if you look in the big scheme and the worldwide scheme of things. He's a middle manager. He's doing his bidding to, and when he gets done being president, he will be elevated to doing worldwide bidding for the bankers, the European bankers who put him in office, basically, and prevented, for example, Hillary Clinton from being in office because she was not a team player. But anyway, that's not the point. Back to the scientists, tailoring their science to the financial community's needs, a tremendous, tremendous disservice to science. And I want to read some quotes from this article. Let me start out by saying that they want to organize in what they call cells. Now, cells we normally associate with terrorism, terrorists in sleeper cells around the country, around the world, where they are so-called cells of people who are organized and could pop out at any minute to cause terrorism. Well, the scientists are using that term, and they want to develop cells of scientists and financial community investors in various regions of the country. They want these all over the United States so that they can influence if anything happens in the newspaper or any event. They can be constantly there pumping information locally into the local newspaper, news media, or whatever. So to cause that constant influence in public opinion. And so here's what they say. They say, for instance, there could be a cell for water issues in the Southwest. The cells would be populated with individuals and stakeholders working on those particular topics, creating an organized framework for discussion and collaboration. And so if the scientists know what the financial community wants in terms of answers, in terms of climate change, they can tailor their discussions, their articles, their scientific papers to meet what the financial community needs so that the financial community can get a payback on their investment. Notice that they're talking about water. How does climate change connect with water? So I'm going to read this again. This is reading verbatim. And by the way, for you, those of you who are not familiar, the term stakeholders means investors. Anybody who's invested time or money, and they're a stakeholder because they want something back. They're not there just on a volunteer basis, like the Royal Bank of Canada puts a lot of money into Canada, into cleanup projects, and everybody's out there helping the environment. And the Royal Bank of Canada is there sometimes contributing as much as $50 million a year. Why are they doing that? Because the Royal Bank of Canada is the central Western Hemisphere control point for water for the Rothschild Banking worldwide empire. And so now you see why the Royal Bank of Canada is so interested in doing good community deed work, because they're always out there in the forefront. They're doing this just to be a good citizen. No, they're doing it because ultimately they want to control the water. Anyway, I'll read this again. This, once again, is from the American Geophysical Union Weekly Newsletter, volume 94, number 24. And so from this past June, it says, for instance, now this is the scientists, the American Meteorological Society leaders, talking. They're saying, for instance, there could be a cell for water issues in the Southwest. The cells could be populated with individuals and stakeholders working on those particular topics, creating an organized framework for discussion and collaboration. The scientists want to mold their science to what the financial community needs so that the financial community will get their money back. So the scientists are like pigs at a trough. What do you want us to say so we can get our slop in the bucket here? That's what the scientists are saying. They are scientific prostitutes. That's the best thing you can say about science today. And unfortunately, this is going to the last question is, who's going to pay for this? The answer is you. You are going to pay for it because the financial community is going to expect a return on its investment investing in scientific, basically salaries and research, you know, most of it into salaries. So the scientists have a paycheck. But who's going to pay for this? Well, you are in elevated water pricing, in water control, and you are going to lose ownership of water rights. So you are going to pay for this, and the scientists are going to be central to this. Anyway, okay, just wanted to talk about that a little bit. But I always talk about being water independent. My most recent book, Water, it's an ebook, only available in ebook format, talks about the worldwide grab for power regarding water. It's underway right now. It's been underway for a long time. And my book exposes this for what it is, for the international control of water. The international bankers are who have controlled oil, energy, the concept of a 40-hour-a-week work week, so that everybody's running around like little slaves, burning up the maximum amount of resources just to survive. And the financial crisis where people lost their homes. A lot of people think, oh, this was an economic downturn. No, this was not an economic downturn. It was a planned theft of the biggest section of wealth in the American public, their homes. This was not by accident or an economic downturn or some. This was a very well-planned, well-orchestrated theft of your wealth. And so at any rate, that is happening with water. And the price tag on water is going to be more than oil. Someday you'll be paying $4 a gallon for water. But wait a minute. You already are paying that amount of money for water. If you go into the gas station and buy a bottle of water, or a little bottle for a dollar, you're paying about $8 a gallon for that water, between $4 and $8 a gallon. You are already paying big money for water. And that water, by the way, was probably taken from a natural resource by a company that didn't pay anything for it. Pure profit. But they can do it because there are no holds barred on water. So anyway, my latest book, Water, it discusses that, the worldwide grab for power on water, and it lists a whole laundry list of things that you can do as an individual to become water independent. So I'm not going to go review that on the air, but make sure you go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and understand what's going on with water. This is going to be the biggest factor in your life in the future. It already is the biggest factor, and it's going to get worse. By the way, I always say this, I could sell flashlights and emergency knives or other kinds of things, or I don't. I've chosen to concentrate on water filtration products. I have my own line now. It's the very good pricing for the highest quality filtration equipment. And, for example, I have my pre-filter, which pre-filters water It fits any modern gravity feed water filter. It pre-filters the water, and if in a case of an emergency, if we have nuclear fallout, if we have chemtrails or whatever, you can pre-filter your water before it goes into your relatively clean gravity water filter. That's the only place that's available is on my webpage, www.jmccsci.com. And also the modular filtration and storage system filters and stores up to 20 gallons of water in sealed containers. These are tightly sealed that lock the covers, so no matter what's going on outside, you have clean water inside. You can add storage capacity to that in 6.5 gallon containers. So you can add capacity to that in 13-gallon increments. I also have the countertop water filters. Those are a new item to the product line. Personal filter, a small 1-liter personal filter that you can take on travel. You can put it in your purse or in a briefcase and have clean water no matter where you are. It's something that was developed for military use, and it's a great little item. It's something I always carry with me. No matter where you are, you can get a liter of fresh water, and it filters a liter in about an hour, and I think it's about a little over an hour. Gravity feed also, no hoses, no electric. You can have it any place. And then the stainless steel water filter or water bottles in 27-ounce and 40-ounce. And so stop using plastic bottles, please. Get yourself a set, and for the whole family, a set of either 27-ounce. These are only sold in sets of six. But 27-ounce or 40-ounce. And when you filter your water, put your water into these stainless steel containers, and you have your own water supply system. You know you're getting clean water because it's your own filtered water. Most of the water you buy in a plastic bottle in the store is not even filtered. It's some kind of pretty name on there, like spring water. Well, it's no such thing. It's either out of the faucet, just like you get it, or out of a lake, and put directly into bottles without filtration. Then there's the accessories, the water filter accessories. I also have the dome filters now. They're little short dome filters, about 4 inches in diameter. Very high capacity. They have twice the capacity of filtering water as the standard 7-inch. I've got a new 7-inch filter with fluoride capacity in it. It takes out fluoride and arsenic right in the filter itself. And then the standard 7-inch filters and the arsenic fluoride add-on filters. All of those available on the webpage. Also, all the filters and accessories available in 10 packs. You can buy 10 at a time at reduced savings. You basically buy about 9, get one for free when you buy them 10 at a time. And then all my books, e-books, all my books are in e-book format except for the Calculate Primes book. Then there's the DVDs and CDs. Okay, enough promotion of items, but this issue with water is huge. And I recommend that you tell your friends. They should all go and get the water book. This is something that affects everybody from little kids to grandmas to engineers to scientists to non-scientists, truck drivers, moms, dads, every place. Water is the issue. Anyway, that's why I finally put out a water book. It had been sitting on the shelf waiting for a long time, and the time was right now. Anyway, okay, back to the scientific topic for tonight. Talking about comets and the comet activity of the sun. And I first wanted to talk about centrifuges. Now, I've talked about this on my show before, but it's part of this whole discussion, so I'll give you a quick review. We typically think of a centrifuge along the lines of medical or chemical analysis. What happens is, let's say you take a blood sample. You go to the doctor, they take a blood sample, and they're going to run some tests. They take the blood, and they put it in a test tube, and they set this in a spinning device with the test tube sticking out sideways, basically, and it spins very fast. And what happens is the denser cells, etc., in your blood sink towards the bottom of the test tube, and the chemicals, etc., of lesser density basically float to the top. It's just like if you put a series of items in water, some will sink, some will float, and some will float to a various degrees. That's the principle of a hydrometer. For example, if you have a battery, you're testing a battery, you take this long syringe-looking thing, you stick it down into a lead-acid battery, you take some liquid out of the cell, and there's four balls in there. And depending on the density of the liquid, some of the balls will float and some will sink. And I can't remember, if they all float, then you have a good solution of acid in your battery. I believe that's how it is. If one ball sinks, well, then you're a little bit low on charge. If two balls sink, then you're lower. And if all four balls sink, then you have no charge in your battery. It's just a way of measuring the density of the water in your battery that's partly acid. So, okay. The concept of a centrifuge is differentiating, the differentiation of different qualities, in this case density. Something that's more dense, that weighs more per unit volume, will move out to the very end of the test tube. The same thing happens in the solar system. We have the solar wind, and we have other varying conditions, electrical conditions, and it's a very complex set of conditions. It's not just one condition, it's many conditions working together. But the end result is that there's a lot of iron and lead and heavy elements like that relatively close to the sun. There are rings, the zodiacal disk. Some people say zodiacal. I believe that's incorrect pronunciation. But there's a disk of dust that surrounds the sun. It's kind of like a Saturnian ring that surrounds the sun. And it is primarily made up of heavy elements. And when comets go through this region, you can see them picking up the heavy elements in their tail. You can see it spectroscopically. Although scientists don't like to talk about that, because that would prove what I'm talking about, and how would a dirty snowball know to start producing lead and iron every time it gets close to the sun? Well, it wouldn't. Just the same way that Schumacher-Levy 9, there was a comet, back in the mid-90s, that came in and crashed into Jupiter. It broke up into 21 pieces, and the 21 pieces came from outer space, crashed into the upper surface of Jupiter. But before they did, they were water comets, just like any comet out in the solar system, primarily water. And as soon as they got into the realm around Jupiter, magically, one by one, they all turned into sulfur dioxide comets. In other words, the tail material of the comet was primarily sulfur dioxide. This is a common element around Jupiter, and when at the time I had been working with Russian scientists, Russian atmospheric scientists, who also had comrades, so to speak, who were comet scientists, outer space scientists, and they recognized that that's what was happening because they had been studying my work, and they made a public announcement. They said, there's no way that this could happen with ice ball comets. How would the ice ball know that it had to start setting off sulfur dioxide when it got close to Jupiter? Well, it doesn't make any sense. But the point is that comets outside of the realm of Jupiter can also become dominated, or at least a significant amount of the tail material can be in the form of sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide, if you look at, in fact, you can look this up, go to the internet, and look up pictures of comet Schumacher Levy 9. And so that's spelled Shu, just like Shu, S-H-O-E. Macker, M-A-C-K-E-R, that's Sir Gene Schumacher. That was the first name of the discoverer of this particular comet. Levy is L-E-V-Y. Levy was the other, they worked together, Schumacher and Levy. And 9 indicates their ninth, the number 9, the Arabic numeral 9, indicates their ninth comet discovery together. So comet Schumacher-Levy 9, that's what you look up. Look at pictures of it as it's coming into Jupiter, and they're all red. Now, a red comet, that's an interesting concept because we typically think of them as white and with water in the tail. But a comet that has a red tinge to it, remember last fall we had a comet that was green, and it was a characteristic green color. Well, that was typically the colors of the chemicals in the comet tail, fluorescing in those colors in green. So at any rate, now we're talking about red comets. Let me take us in a side note here. Over the past couple weeks, there, and a lot of people have heard about this, and people have asked me to comment. And so I'll make a quick comment, but I don't want to waste a lot of time on this. Every time NASA or the federal agencies or whatever want to come out with misinformation, I don't want to waste my time having to go through this. I talked a bit on the John Moore Show Wednesday morning about this issue. I talked about it yesterday morning also. I was a guest on the Joyce Riley Show for a couple hours. There's a woman that claims she worked for NASA. Apparently it's been substantiated, called Patty Broussard. And she made a claim. She's got YouTube videos out there, etc. She's making claims that there is a second sun out by Jupiter, and it's moving in to the solar system, and it's got 7 planets associated with it. And then she shows a picture. Well, I looked at the picture, and from what I'm seeing, the picture indicates comet Ison that's near the orbit of Jupiter. So that's what I'm... But then she says, this star, the second sun, which it is not, is pushing a big red cloud, and it's already interacting with Mars. And I'm going, whoa, okay, here's the carrot. Here's the deal. They're trying to cover for what I had said is going to happen with Mars. In September, mid-September to 1st of October, comet Ison is going to start interacting electrically with Mars, and it probably already is from what this statement is saying, although we don't really have a good indication of what's going on with Mars right now. But anyway, here's the situation. They're saying that this second sun is going to push. Now, how this happens, how does a second sun push a red cloud? And you wouldn't call it a red cloud, you would call it by its chemical species. So you can tell all of this is misinformation meant to misguide the public and to squelch the real cause of the interaction with Mars' atmosphere, which is comet Ison, which is coming in and will start interacting with Mars around mid-September to late September, coming up here just in about a month. And so they're trying to head off at the pass the public's understanding of what's going on. They are deathly afraid of seeing people wake up in the morning, and this, by the way, the way you're going to see this, wake up early in the morning, starting around September 15th to 20th, somewhere in that time frame, and start looking into the eastern sky. As the moon becomes less of a factor, around the 1st of October is the time when comet Ison will be just a mere 7 million miles away from Mars, and we should be able to see this very clearly in the early morning sky without any moon. It should be very visible. A pair of binoculars might help, and by the way, always be sure You never look at the sun with binoculars. But this viewing opportunity is well before the sun ever comes up. And so be ready for that. I'll be giving more details on exactly what to look for and where and what time. But basically, around the end of September, get up early in the morning on a clear day, look towards the eastern sky, and look for the comet interacting with Mars. Mars is a red planet. You won't be able to miss it. It'll be very clearly up there in the morning sky. So, but anyway, this Patty Pizzard story is complete misinformation. Here's the key to understanding. She apparently did work for all of these aerospace corporations, for NASA as a scientist. In that capacity, she would have had to have had signed non-disclosure agreements, basically gag orders. When Dan Golden came into NASA in the 1990s, his job was to put the security lid on NASA, and everybody at NASA had to sign up, and everybody subsequent to that had to sign, and probably an annually had to sign, non-disclosure agreements. They are not at liberty to simply go out and start shooting off their mouth. And if they do, they would be sequestered, dragged off into a room, and you would never hear from them. They would not be allowed to have YouTube videos anywhere, and those YouTube videos would come down absolutely right now. So the fact that she is out there running around shooting off her mouth supports the fact that NASA is supporting this. NASA is promoting it. NASA is allowing it to happen, and they're allowing one of their employees under gag orders to put out extremely high levels of misinformation. You see what I mean? And all of these other aerospace corporations would haul her off too and sequester her. So this is a coordinated effort to allow misinformation to be passed off to the public. But what is the biggest point they're trying to make? That this will affect Mars. And they don't want to talk about the fact that in September, Comet Ison is going to start to interact electrically with Mars, like I've been saying. Okay, so anyway, that's the end of that. But So that gave me the idea that I should be talking about sulfur dioxide comets, because if NASA is putting out this misinformation, my interpretation of it is that very much Comet Ison is a sulfur dioxide comet. And we're going to see it'll lose that property as it passes Mars and starts heading into the solar system, the inner solar system. It'll have an encounter with Mercury, little planet Mercury. Also, we'll be able to see that, and I'll be talking about when and where, prior to the November time frame. So it's going to start moving very quickly. But this whole Patty Broussard misinformation stunt tells me that they are worried about Comet Ison dragging sulfur dioxide in and depositing it into Mars's atmosphere, as Mars will be in the tail of that comet for a good period of time. So Mars is going to have some terraforming going on at the hand of Comet Ison. So the other thing that the Patty Pizzard story does is diffuse or take away any credit of Comet Ison and puts it on this second sun thing, which is absolutely absurd. But if that's the best they can come up with, they're really hurting. The poor administrators at NASA should hire some better misinformation agents, because this story doesn't hold water from square one. Anyway, but let's talk about sulfur dioxide comets. Now, let's review what a comet is. A comet is basically an electrical cosmic vacuum cleaner. It's drawing in vast amounts of material, and that material comes from the local environment. So the majority of material we typically see in a comet is water, but there's many, many other chemicals to a lesser degree. So hydrogen and oxygen have to be the primary components in our solar system throughout. Remember, I was talking about centrifuges and the ability of the solar wind and other electrical properties, other varying properties in the solar system to separate out the various chemicals. Sulfur dioxide is extremely prevalent around the orbit of Jupiter. And why this is or how this works, we don't have a lot of understanding. And here again, boys and girls, people who want to study science, there are real science issues that have to be studied. Why is sulfur so prevalent at Jupiter? What's the centrifuge effect that causes sulfur to reside primarily around the orbit of Jupiter? Oh, you get out towards Neptune, and it's nitrogen. There's a lot of nitrogen out between Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and those planets out there. The nitrogen compounds, the nitrogen chemicals, the nitrogen-based chemicals are very prevalent out there, whereas sulfur and sulfur dioxide, etc., are more prevalent around Jupiter. What is the cause of that? What's the filtering effect, so to speak? So there are many, I understand, I can see this going on, but I don't have all the answers because we got to get equipment out there to study this. We have to get equipment out there with scientists who are looking for the right effects, looking for the right answers. So this gives hopefully some kids an encouragement that someday they can grow up and be space scientists, but studying correct science, not the fairy tale science that comes out of NASA these days. So basically, a sulfur dioxide comet is simply a comet. It's in a region of a high concentration of sulfur dioxide. So let's go back to Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 back in the mid-1990s. It's a comet in the solar system. It's a single nucleus water comet attracting water and probably a lot of other chemicals. And so one day it breaks up. It breaks up into 21 separate pieces, and astronomers start to follow the path of these, and it becomes obvious that they're going to crash into Jupiter. Now, interestingly enough, NASA said, oh, that's nothing. They'll disappear. They're just little chunks of ice, and when they disappear into Jupiter's atmosphere, they'll probably burn up, and then nothing will happen. The Russians, on the other hand, had every instrument they possibly could muster. They had them focused on Jupiter. Well, one of the big problems here was that when Schumacher-Levy 9, the 21 pieces, came into Jupiter, they were going to be on the far side of Jupiter. We would only see the effect a few hours later as Jupiter rotated around. By the way, Jupiter has about a 10-hour rotation period. So in a few hours, Jupiter would rotate around, and we would get to see where the comet pieces of the comet nuclei hit after the fact. So at any rate, the Russians had a lot of equipment, a lot of microwave and radio telescope equipment focused on this, as well as optical equipment. And so Russia had the good nighttime view. The United States did not. So anyway, what happened is as the 21 pieces water comets came into the realm of Jupiter, one by one, they turned into sulfur dioxide comets. And like I said, you can go on the internet, just look up a Schumacher-Levy 9 comet, and you'll see one of those pictures. And it's like on the cover of my comets book, by the way, you can actually go to my webpage, thejmccsci.com, go to the sales page and look down for the comets ebook, and you will just click on it. The cover is there, I believe a picture of the cover, and you will see a picture, the cover picture of the book, my ebook Comets. The cover picture is Schumacher-Levy 9, the 21 pieces, all red, sulfur dioxide tails. And so as they came in, they changed from water to sulfur dioxide. That's because the material, the local material in that region was sulfur dioxide. Then they hit the atmosphere of Jupiter, 1, 2, 3, up to 21 pieces, hitting the atmosphere of Jupiter. And, of course, the scientists knew exactly when these would hit to the second. So they had their instrumentation trained on Jupiter. But remember, the pieces of the comet were hitting on the far side of Jupiter. But what happened is they got extremely powerful electromagnetic and like radio wave, microwave, and also visible spectrum light. The light was bouncing off the moons of Jupiter, which were on the far side of Jupiter. The EMP or the radiation coming off of these impacts with Jupiter was so powerful that they could actually measure it from Earth being reflected off of the moons of Jupiter. So what this told the scientists in Russia is that, hey, there's no way some little snowball did this. These were the equivalent, and they could actually calculate, they could make estimates, and they knew the size of the nuclear pieces. They could make an estimate of the power in these explosions, and they made estimates in terms of nuclear explosions. An immense, immense amount of energy was expended as these pieces of nuclei came in and hit Jupiter. So much that they could actually measure it being reflected off of the moons of Jupiter, even though we couldn't see it. Then Jupiter swung around, and you could see the 21 splotches of sulfur dioxide, like circles, kind of like a circle around a point. You could see where the sulfur dioxide from the comet tail laid into the atmosphere of Jupiter, the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, and created a little ring where each one of these 21 pieces hit. So the word that came out of the Russian scientific community was, this is the death knell of the Dirty Snowball Comet model. The Dirty Snowball Comet model cannot explain anything, and they basically heralded my comet model as correct. It was one of the many, many, many proofs that my comet model was correct. But at any rate, the sulfur dioxide comet is nothing more than a comet that is in the region of Jupiter. Here we come. We're in 2013. Comet Ison is in its way in, and it crossed. Now it's dropping down to where it's getting near the ecliptic. It's going to cross the ecliptic plane, that is the plane of the planets, as it crosses by Mars. It'll pass down into a little bit below the ecliptic plane. But the point is that it is hooking into already. It's beyond the orbit of Jupiter. It's getting close to Mars. It's picking up speed. It's dropping down to the ecliptic, the plane of the planets. And it's starting to connect into that sulfur dioxide region around the orbit of Jupiter. So Comet Ison, it's very clear from the Patty Broussard disinformation piece that Comet Ison, NASA is fearing that the public will wake up and understand that this comet is not a water comet, but it is a sulfur dioxide comet. Red is the color, and that's why they have in the Patty Broussard piece, they have her saying that this is a big red cloud being pushed by the second sun. What goofy. I mean, nobody in science would make a claim that a star is pushing a red cloud. How absolutely absurd. And where did this red cloud come from? Why doesn't our sun have a red cloud around it? How do stars push a red cloud? Why is it red? You know, none of these questions are answered. So the information is clearly to misguide the public and to direct it away from the fact that Comet Ison is becoming a sulfur dioxide comet, and when it gets to Mars, Mars is going to have an influx of sulfur dioxide. Now, let's go back a few thousand years to the ancients. The ancients talk about, and I've talked about this on previous radio shows, the ancients talk about what they call the Red Hand of Death. And what this amounts to is both auroras and sulfur dioxide. Auroras are electrical activity that are caused by electron or proton current coming into the upper atmosphere, up into the ionosphere, and then passing down into the regions of dense more dense atmosphere in creating the effects we see in the auroras, and also the sulfur dioxide coming in. It would somewhat form in what the ancients described. It was like fingers. So it was like a hand, and then all of a sudden fingers dropping down, and it appeared to be like a hand. So they called it the red hand of death. That's the imagery we get from the Old Testament. Also, the red auroras occur at lower latitudes during times of high electrical activity, which you would expect when a comet is near. So also, this comet Ison will be close enough to Mars where it should have some significant electrical discharge activity to Mars. We could literally see serious effects on the planet Mars because of the close passage. Of course, that's not going to affect us on Earth. Nobody here is going to die as a result of that. There's no reason for panic. And it's not a second sun with seven planets around it. That's all foolishness. That's all silliness. But Mars is going to have some changes here in the upcoming months. Atmosphere, possibly surface conditions. It may pick up a good deal of atmosphere overnight. It's very possible that Mars' atmosphere could increase tremendously as it sets in the comet tail for a period of time. We could see some major league changes on the planet Mars. Why don't they want people to look at this? Well, the simple reason is because that would verify the claims of Velikovsky. It would verify my theoretical work that comets do interact with planets on more than just a, well, if they happen to impact basis. No, impact is one of the least likely scenarios for a comet. Okay, I'm going to switch gears here. There's another topic that's very important. It's currently in the news, and a lot of people have questions about this. The power surges. What happens if we get a solar flare that causes a power surge? And there's been discussions. Could it blow out transformers, or will it not blow out transformers? Could an electric surge blow out a transformer? And we have one of the main components in the electric grid would be transformers. Transformers convert alternating current and voltage to either higher, it's a step up or a step down transformer. But a certain amount of power comes in the left side through coils. These coils are not linked electrically, but through alternating magnetic fields through a central core of iron. And those are then transferred into another wrapped set of wires that go out the other side. And so if you have a certain amount of power coming in to the left side, it's coming in at a certain voltage and a certain current level. Coming out the other side, if the voltage goes up, then the current goes down. If the voltage goes down, then the current goes up to match, so that the same amount of power comes out the right side of the transformer as came in on the left side of the transformer. And transformers do not, by the way, have left and right sides. I'm just using that as a simplified example. But the end result is you have power coming in. There's an electromagnetic exchange that happens in the middle of the transformer, and out the other side comes an altered voltage and current. And the reason you use these in the electric grid is because power is typically generated at a lower voltage. To transport that power, you want it at a very high voltage and a very low current level. And the current is what causes the power loss in the cable. So you want your transmission lines at the highest possible voltage and the lowest amount of current. And this was the whole big discussion between Edison and at the beginning of the 1900s, with Tesla winning out with his AC alternating technology. Edison was promoting DC. And for many obvious reasons now, AC is much better. So anyway, there are DC transport systems also. But the point is that to step down the voltage and to handle the voltage, just to manipulate it, it's much easier to do it in an alternating form, because you can use transformers. You can you take that high voltage, you drop it down to a normal voltage, like 120 volts, and so this happens in a couple stages between the high voltage power lines that transport across the country, or across the countryside, and drop down into a couple stages, finally to 120 volts that you get at your house. Okay, the question is, if we have a major power surge from a solar flare or something, will it burn out the transformers? And I want to tell you that yes, they will. I was asked this on Joyce Riley yesterday. And there are people that say, no, a transformer would never burn out. Well, here's the situation. If you have a big enough current surge, and that's a current surge is just by its very nature alternating because it's not a constant DC, those surges move very quickly. And what happens is you get a tremendous surge of current in the wire. Current and resistance in the wire, the resistance causes heat or energy loss. And so a big surge could cause enough energy to burn the wiring in the transformer. Now, that's a theoretical explanation. I have seen personally transformers blow up because of surges. Some people say that lightning would never blow out a transformer. They are wrong. I have personally seen transformers blow. And when they do, they blow up tremendously. I mean, this is a big fire. You have oil in there that's burning. You have oil coolant, and then you have the wire. And then you still have the electrical connection going on, so you see electrical sparks. It's quite the thing to behold, to see a big industrial-sized transformer exploding and burning because of a surge. I have personally seen them. I know they happen, and I saw what happened to cause it. It was a lightning strike that wasn't even at the transformer. It was nearby, so the lightning surge had to come up the equipment to the transformer, and it blew that thing. When that thing started to burn, there were sparks. It looked like the 4th of July going off and burning. And when we went over and looked at it afterwards, the metal was burned. This baby was hot. And so, yes, transformers can be destroyed by electrical surges. There's a theoretical reason, and there's a observation that I have personally seen these. Now, there are other components in the electrical grid, but the end result is that if we do have such an electrical surge from the sun, then the grid would not burn up 100%. Only bits and pieces of it would burn up. And that's why when I've been talking about this, that they're getting ready for a false flag, basically false kill shot, so to speak. A kill shot is when a solar flare hits and takes down the power grid. They've been prepping the public for years for this. And so right now the solar conditions are at an absolute minimum. The solar state is one of the lowest in a couple hundred years. So there's not a high probability, and you always have to talk in terms of probability, but we're peaking at the solar cycle and the sun is just flat dead. It's hardly doing anything. We very rarely get a significant solar flare, let alone anything that would cause a serious power outage. A couple weeks ago, some scientists out of a think tank in Washington, or independent observers, went through Woolsey, the ex-director of the CIA, to try and influence Congress to make them understand about a kill shot. But they did something stupid. They made reference to a supposed kill shot that barely missed us. And I went back and looked. I don't see any record of anything narrowly missing us that you would call a kill shot. So I don't know what happened to their announcement. I think it pretty much fell on deaf ears. But the end result is if we have major damage to the grid system due to a real power outage or a real solar flare, it's not going to take out 100% of the grid. It won't take out everything. It'll take bits and pieces, and some pieces will be left. That's why they have to do it as a false flag event. Take a solar flare that's coming at us, and that solar flare, they say, oh, that's what caused it, and then they physically pull the switch on power outage around the United States and around the world. And that would be the one way that you could physically shut down everybody. The question on Joyce Riley yesterday, somebody asked about an alien agenda. And that would be one of the fourth in the Wernher von Braun series of false flag type of control, the third of which was the Cold War, the final one supposedly being a false alien invasion to give power over to the power elite. But I've said, a power outage would be the best way to control everybody, because even with an alien, false alien attack, it wouldn't affect everybody. Not everybody would believe it, especially today. And it wouldn't have the effect as a power outage. If you pull the power switch on everybody, nobody's going nowhere. Nobody's saying nothing. You have shut everything down. And so they know that. And so that's why I think that the power outage scenario for trying to grab worldwide power is something that is in the near future, let me say. And I don't make predictions, but I would say all of the indicators for me right now are pointing to the basically what some people call the New World Order. I call them the Rothschild Banking International, ruled by financial terrorism, that group that owns our Federal Reserve Bank in Washington, controls Congress, make sure that people like Obama get elected, or the Bushes or the Clintons, that do their bidding for them under secret guises. That's what's going on. And so I'm expecting in the next month or two a false flag solar kill shot event. And so I'm just telling people, become prepared, become water independent, be able to take care of yourself for 3 to 6 months, because when it goes, it's not going to come back soon. Electricity, without it, you are flat up the creek without a paddle, literally. Nobody's going anywhere. Nobody's doing anything. So that's why I have the water filter products. That's, to help you become prepared, help you understand what's going on in the solar system. And an important part is understanding how science is used to control the public. And that's there's no other way to put it. It's not a matter of politics or talking politics. It's reality. It's how science is used to control the public. And the scientists will bite off on it every day as long as they get a paycheck. Once again, the webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com. And also, all of my radio shows are archived there for the past 10 years. See you next week.